The MDT Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to this episode of the MDT Podcast, a bonus episode if you like. This week we spoke with carers and care workers who support older adults in the community. If you haven't had a listen to the main episode yet, do go back and have a listen before you have a listen to this. During the episode, we spoke to two lovely professionals working with carers and care workers, and the conversations I had with them were so useful that it was really difficult to cut down for the main episode. So we decided to release them as a bonus just for you. First up, I spoke to Jennifer Twist, CEO of Care for the Carers East Sussex. We chat about carers passports, care groups, and the key information that we as health professionals should know and how to make referrals for supporting carers.
So my name's Jennifer Twist and I'm the Chief Executive at Care for the Carers, and we are the Carers Centre for East Sussex. So we support any unpaid carers in East Sussex.
Lovely. So first question is, who are carers?
So carers are, it's anybody who is looking after somebody who couldn't manage without their help, either because they are unwell, they're living with a disability or frailty, and that could be a relative or a friend. So just thinking about here in East Sussex, there's at least over sort of 69,000 people in East Sussex caring unpaid for a family member or a friend. And then also during the pandemic, there's about another 35,000 carers identified locally across the UK. Just as a sort of comparison, that looks like over 6.5 million people. So it's quite a large number of people. And we tend to say that about 1 in 8 of us are carers. And in terms of older people, about a third of carers are aged over 65. There's also a growing number of carers who are of a working age, and also we support some children and young people who care. So it's really quite broad range of people who can be carers. It's really important to highlight that carers come from all walks of life as well. And I've just mentioned young carers who are typically helping a relative, usually a parent. And we work with people right through to quite elderly carers. It's quite common for older people to be in mutually caring relationships, perhaps say in a couple where they're looking after one another. But we're also seeing lots of working age people who are needing to kind of consider, do I need to leave my job to be a carer, or who juggle work and care? And that's where some of the stresses that come in for carers. Typically, it's a term I would say a lot of people don't necessarily identify with the term carer for a range of reasons. I guess a lot of us don't want to be labelled anyway. And there can be a bit of a stigma attached to it. So feeling that you just should cope and not kind of need that label, and you're doing something that is part of your role. For example, you know, I'm their mum, I'm their husband, I'm their wife. So yeah, it's a bit of an overview of kind of who carers are, and you know, there's a range of different things that carers do as well.
I think the thing that jumped out to me there was just how many people it is. Like East Sussex is an area I'm really familiar with. It's my local area. That's huge, like 69,000 people. That's like Wembley, isn't it? Like multiple Wembleys. That's mad.
Yeah, it's a really good thing to try and kind of put that into, because often we hear big numbers and they don't really make sense. But also for me, that kind of 1 in 8 of us, and basically we're all going to be a carer at some point in our lives. It's highly likely. And caring can be something that's right through from something quite small to a really very substantial long-term caring role. But I think the key thing also to highlight is this is essential support that carers are providing, and it's not paid. We wouldn't describe it as a voluntary role either, because most people kind of just become carers, and it can be something that can happen overnight, or it can grow sort of very gradually and change and become more intensive. So carers are doing things, some of the things that in particular in the health field we might expect carers to be doing. They're helping with personal care, they're helping with washing and dressing, going to the toilet, assisting with mobility, medication, those sorts of things. But also it's right and proper that we recognise carers who are helping with things like shopping, laundry, cleaning, cooking, filling in forms, managing money, emotional support, and kind of you don't need to be living with the person that you care for either to be a carer. a lot of people provide that support from quite a distance.
Now you've said it, it makes sense, but I definitely wouldn't always consider the person that doesn't live with the person. But I can think about my own family, my parents supporting my grandma. They don't live with her, but they do all the things, like they do the shopping for her, they do her bills. That's exactly it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, it's so many people just when they fall into a caring role, they just see themselves as just doing the right thing. And obviously something generally we want to do, it can be really rewarding. And so a lot of what the things that we talk about, we're often highlighting the challenges and so on, the impact on carers' own health. But it's also really important to kind of, you know, acknowledge that it can be one of the most rewarding things that you do in your life to really support someone and enable them to have that really good quality of life. Yeah, it's a really sort of rich and varied thing being a carer. There's so many different types of caring roles.
So what and how do care for the carers work with the people they, how do you identify the people? How do you find them? And what support do you sort of do for them?
Oh, there's a range of questions in there. So
there was.
Yeah, sorry. No, so care for the carers, we are, I've mentioned with the Carer Centre for East Sussex. So what that means is that we're here for anyone in a caring role. And it's also our job, we're commissioned on behalf of the local authority and the NHS to be the sort of front door for carers to access support and services. So we provide a range of services ourselves, but we also do a lot of work with our partners. So that includes NHS professionals and colleagues. It includes social care colleagues, but it also includes a whole range of colleagues and partner organisations within the voluntary sector too. So I guess that last bit, it answers part of your question about how do we identify carers. So a big part of that is making sure that practitioners understand that we're here for that and can refer into us. So we maintain those relationships so that we can be accessible to carers and also professionals who are likely to come across carers in their work. So we also do a range of things like social media and kind of communication out to reach and identify carers, along with things like providing training for partner organisations on carers and their needs and how to identify, and most importantly, how to refer on to us, because we really understand that in particular in the NHS, but also within social care, the pressures are absolutely huge. And we, you know, we're not reaching out to partners and saying, you must do this extra thing. What we're actually doing is saying, we're here to support you. So we work closely with our partners to enable us to essentially take the elements of supporting carers that are, for example, non-clinical, off the desk of GPs and practice staff, so that actually they can make a swift referral through to us and then we can take over that sort of preventative support for the carer. But in terms of what that looks like, what we provide, a big part of what we do is information, advice and guidance through our carers hub. And then also that there are various different ways that we help carers to stay connected with one another and with people who understand caring and the pressures of that, helping carers to access emergency support quickly. We provide a young carer service as well. We provide a counselling service. So quite a few different ways that we provide emotional support, things like a keeping in touch telephone service where our volunteers will give isolated carers a regular phone call. We have a carer's card. That's the big thing that lots of carers are really keen to have and that draws people to us. And that has three different functions. So it identifies you as a carer. You might carry it in your wallet. And if the worst happened and you fell down and emergency services were called, it actually says on that card who you are, but also that someone depends on you. And then another thing that carers really benefit from is that a range of businesses in East Sussex support that scheme and give discounts and things to carers, which is lovely. And then finally, we work with the County Council to link that card to a backup care plan. So that if you take that example that something's gone wrong, either with your own health or or something unexpected, then there is a backup plan whereby phone number on the card can be rung and adult social care has all the information about who can step in if you can't care for the person who you support. So the carers card is a really big one, and we're kind of really interested in working more with our partners in health around that as well, around some of the new NHS England schemes that are coming out. So
yeah, goodness, that sounds like such a useful thing to know about. And I just wanted to ask about that. I remember during the pandemic when there was reduced visiting at the hospital, when taking people in with a relative to A&E, and the A&E staff would say, oh, well, have they got a carer's card if you said, oh, this person's with this person because they're a carer. Is that the same carer's card? Is it different? Is it separate to where the government, there's like a some sort of register or something, I believe, in carers? I don't really know. Or is that all a big misnomer and it's not at all?
Yeah, well, I guess in terms of nationally, there are probably loads of carers cards. So this the scheme we've got was established really early on at Care for the Carers, and it was an idea that local carers had. It started off with these little orange bits of card we used to cut out and laminate and things. And but it's evolved into what it is today, and there are similar schemes all over. And certainly in terms of the rest of Sussex, there are similar schemes there. So yeah, lots of examples of that. But there isn't really one central place where carers are registered. For East Sussex, we try to, you know, we register carers and we're that port of call. But what we would like to do is kind of build on some of those experiences that you described in the pandemic, where people, where, you know, partners were looking to carers to identify themselves and carers were seeking to identify themselves. We'd love to sort of build on that and adopt something called a carer's passport in East Sussex, which would have, if that was in place during the pandemic, it would have really, really helped in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. We've just introduced them. So when I was in the pandemic, I worked in Eastbourne for the ambulance service. And then now I work in Redhill for the hospital, but I work in A&E, and we've just launched a carer's passport. It's only it's sash specific, but they get a little card, a little lanyard, it gets some discount in the shop, it gets them, and like they get, there's like on the back of the initial booklet, there's information about local carer services, but in the back there's a sticker which goes on the patient's notes, so it tells staff that they've got a carer. It just all links up, and it's really good. Really think it's brilliant. I think I've given that out to a few patients, relatives and things recently, and really felt like I've actually helped by giving that. Before I was like, here's a strange leaflet.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. It's really great if carers can be given that sort of thing when they're identified in the way that you've just described, rather than just a leaflet that goes in a pile in the corner. And that's something that carers, when everything was much more about leaflets and going to people's homes and so on, we would always, when we did a home visit, we would see this mound of leaflets in the corner of the living room or something. And carers do get given a lot of information, but their time is really precious and they're juggling multiple things. So what they really need is that kind of referral or piece of information that is what they need right now and is going to get an outcome for them. So yeah, all those sorts of things are really useful.
So if we think about people who care for older adults specifically, so generally those over 65, what are the sort of common concerns or advice that you give out or interventions that you help with?
So I guess the big one is just simply navigating the health and care system. So, you know, it just can feel like such a maze to carers, and in particular caring for an older person, that there can be a range of different things that suddenly can come onto the horizon. And if you are, for example, a working carer trying to support someone, you know, a parent, for example, that's doubly challenging because you're not necessarily available at the time when services are open to phone up and find out what's happening. Most carers, we've learned, and this is especially true for older people, would expect their GP to be the person they should go to speak to about being a carer, or to say, I'm a carer, I'm really struggling with this. And sadly, the system isn't necessarily geared up for that. So we know that actually by doing that, that's not necessarily the best way for carers to get a kind of swift referral to specialist carer services, because GPs are so, their time is so pressured. they cannot be expected to know about all the details of all the community services. Their focus needs to be on clinical issues. So, you know, that's one of the key things is just where do I go, you know? So another big thing tends to be, you know, and this applies to other groups of carers too, but what happens if I become unwell? Who's going to step in? Who's going to take over? So an example, this morning I was in a meeting with colleagues from a PCN in East Sussex, and they were describing, we were looking at kind of the data for people being admitted into hospital, discharge data, and then readmission data. And there's quite a high amount of people who are being admitted and then discharged and then sadly readmitted in quite a short period of time. And they were talking about, the NHS colleagues were talking about that being very much related to the scenario around the carer and the carer being able to cope. So an example that came through there was a person who was admitted into hospital themselves, but they cared for somebody who had dementia. And ultimately, there was no suitable care available to take over. So the person they cared for needed to be admitted into hospital as well. And that's one of the nightmare scenarios for a lot of carers. It's just, well, what's going to happen? I don't know. So those are the sorts of things that we're helping people to navigate. So often the kind of interventions are around, okay, let's put you in touch with the right person. Let's get you a carer's assessment, or let's support you to do a self-assessment yourself. Sometimes we'll be making phone calls or referrals on behalf of the carer rather than giving them that information because they're just too overwhelmed. But then equally, it's that kind of overwhelm that we're supporting with as well. So supporting that person to look after their own well-being. So many carers will just put themselves last, and it's just kind of, they just end up doing that. We've had a number of carers that we've supported who aren't accessing their own healthcare appointments, even to the point of not accessing chemotherapy treatment that they should be having when they've got cancer. So those sorts of things we can provide support with. We have a grant, for example, that can pay for replacement care to enable people to go to their own health appointments. And equally, just that kind of support to access things that are going to look after you. So it might not be about, you know, an actual doctor's appointment, but, you know, going out for a walk or just taking some time away from it. So the stress tends to be another big thing. And so 100% of the local carers who came back to our annual survey told us about that. So obviously they're not all older carers, but that's just huge, just a huge impact on people's lives. So yeah, during COVID, there were particular things as well that came through for, you know, particularly older carers around just a huge fear of, you know, how do I now care for the person I look after? And also, quite apart from that, the changes in the system during that time and regular services that people relied on, that was just a, you know, a real worry for people. How do I make sure that they're cared for properly when it's now just me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? So things like, you know, daycare, that was a big issue. So, yeah, and I guess these are sometimes things like stress, being very isolated, potentially just, you know, ongoing depression and so on, or exhaustion. Those are the things maybe carers aren't coming to us about, but through the initial dialogue with us, we'll be identifying, actually, you know, this is actually having a real impact on you. And yeah, it can be just really distressing for people that who are sort of supporting through real changes.
And I guess by talking to people who acknowledge that and acknowledge that it's okay to feel the way you are, that we know that's a thing, so that the person doesn't feel like they're just on their own and the only one experiencing it. Because I can imagine sometimes if you became a carer overnight, you might not feel like you know anyone else who is like you.
Yeah.
And so you feel like you're on your own in a really confusing system. Yeah, I can see that would be really useful.
Yeah, no, what you've described, it's very true that it can be very, very isolating. And one of the big things, you've asked me a bit about carers groups and of things around that is that it can just be a bit, just this real penny drop moment when you realize that there are people who get it, because often your own family and friends don't get it because they've not had that in their lives yet. So, you know, they can sometimes just fall away and maybe not be able to support you in the way that you might need. And so to realize that, you know, going, for example, to a carers group or one of our events, you're suddenly in a room full of people who get what it's like, you know, and you don't have to explain, that sense of peer support and being part of a community is really quite meaningful for carers.
Are there any misconceptions about carers or around carers that, or things that people come to you with preconceived ideas about?
So this is, I was thinking about this, and it's kind of more an observation, really. I think that a misconception, and I am thinking about colleagues in health and social care, actually, when I'm saying this, is that carers, and it's not that those colleagues ever say this, I have to be really clear about that, but I think there's a misconception that carers can be quite difficult. And I think that's because carers are often angry, and carers often have to really fight to get any support or indeed to be recognised. So, for example, as you know, as partners in care, it can be really hard to be recognised in that way, and for health and social care professionals to be sharing information with you that you really feel that you need, or indeed as a carer, you know so much about the person that you care for and their needs and, you know, their health and so on, that it can be just incredibly frustrating to not be invited into those conversations or even just to be ignored. And so I think that carers often do present to professionals, you know, health professionals, etc., as quite challenging, really. I think that it can feel, you know, really that you're on the back foot, and actually it's not necessarily those carers have probably bounced around the system, you know, an awful lot before they've landed at your door, so you don't necessarily realize that though straight away. So I think that's one of the misconceptions that has kind of evolved around carers, and I do understand that, you know, you're doing your job, suddenly somebody is there who is, you know, pushing and pushing and fighting. But what we don't necessarily see is the journey they've had to that point. And what we don't necessarily see straight away is just, you know, carers are actually huge problem solvers. They're hugely knowledgeable and really, you know, they're doing everything they can to make sure that the person they care for gets the standard of care that they need and that their needs are met. They don't necessarily always have the language to communicate that in the way that might happen if it was a, you know, a health and social care colleague. So I think that's one of the misconceptions. And I think that's one of the things that actually would be so much better if the system enabled carers to be much more easily included and involved and recognised in a way that just makes that straightforward.
Absolutely, yeah. And includes them in conversations. I think sometimes when someone is, you know, when the person being cared for is hospitalized for whatever reason, and then their care is there, they almost, the things they always do for that person are taken away, and it's not even thought about, like all the power is taken away from them, and they are just there with the person, and actually like giving them some of the power back is probably really valuable, and they can help us so much. I know, like on our wards, they're thinking about things like, do they support with washing and dressing and activities and eating? Well, otherwise, who does that? Yes, it's our nursing staff, but actually, if the carer does it all the time, they'll do it the exact same way as they always do. This is all about norms. Like it's ideal for everybody.
Yeah.
And why are we taking the power away? Just give it back.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also true to say that for a lot of carers, that can be, it's not that they would want the person that they care for to be admitted into hospital, but it can provide, you know, usually by the time carers, by the time somebody is at that point where they need to be hospitalised, that carer's probably on their knees because they've been trying to manage that thing at home and, you know, up to that point without any of the training or, you know, equipment or, you know, all of the stuff that exists in the hospital setting. So yeah, it's that balance of kind of the carer being able to sort of just actually let professionals take over at the moment, but also not just be completely excluded. So that's kind of why one of the things that carers organisations put a lot of time into is recognition, because it is that kind of just that invitation in, really, that open door. But I do think also one of the real challenges is around confidentiality. So that's another thing that organisations like Care for the Carers can help with, working together with NHS and social care partners, is kind of some of those systems being in place around confidentiality and understanding, you know, actually what you can share without perhaps going beyond what the patient is happy with. Shared. And you know, it can be that people sort of really trying their best to respect confidentiality and do the right thing can just get in the way.
There's a balance to be had.
Indeed, yes.
There's an art to finding the balance. It's hard.
Yeah.
So you've kind of covered carers groups, but is there anything else you wanted to say about carers groups? Or
it's the kind of being part of something, the peer support, identifying with others who understand, that's really, really key. It does provide people with just a very short break away from their caring role as well, which is something that's really beneficial for people. And then a lot of carers groups, certainly the ones that we organise, there'll also be some kind of guest speakers come along, so that can be a range of different things, but often it is health and social care professionals or other voluntary organizations, the services available to carers. So there's that opportunity for carers to kind of boost their knowledge of the system, you know, and kind of gain information that will just help them as well. But no, I think it's really about getting together. That's the main thing.
And those carers groups are online and in person now, aren't they? So
we are going to be keeping in East Sussex some online groups. So you know, that's something that will stay, because for some people that's an easier way to get involved. There's also a lot of carers who've been desperate to get back to meeting in person again, so that's happening as well. So yeah, just a mix. And in East Sussex, across the area, there are carers groups dotted around, you know, all over the place. So there's quite a lot out there. And Care for the Carers is, you know, we're also open to either supporting people to set up their own carers groups. We've got a little grant that we can support people to do that with. Or, you know, we'll always look at, are there gaps? Are there carers who've asked us for groups in particular areas?
And then, so my last question on my list was, what knowledge do you think that all health professionals should have about carers and key information that we should be able to provide to our patients and those who support them?
Okay, so I think all health professionals need to know the importance of recognising carers. So just that recognition, by doing that, and that you describe giving somebody that carer's card and the lanyard and so on, it's absolutely crucial, and it opens up. It's something that you can do really quite quickly and open up a wealth of support for that individual. There are organisations, I think the whole of the area that your listeners will be from, there are carers organisations who are specialists in providing support to the carers in your area. So it can feel as though you maybe don't want to go there because you've got such a short amount of time with those people, and your role is not to pick up, you know, the non-clinical things and so on. But actually, you can make a massive difference to that individual in just doing that quick referral. There are usually schemes available. We have the carer's prescription in East Sussex, which is specifically set up for that really swift referral, so that you can give us that piece of work to support that person. But I think the other thing as well is to understand the importance of that on the entire system. So carers who are not identified are not accessing the preventative services that can actually start to prevent a caring relationship from breaking down. Where there's carer breakdown, there are health needs of that carer. The scenario that we described earlier on, where we had somebody being two people admitted into hospital instead of one, essentially, is the risk in terms of the overall NHS, you know, budget. So there's lots that can be done around prevention and actually, you know, stopping the carer's health from deteriorating as well as the person that they care for. So I guess the key bit of information I think that health professionals need to have around carers is the name and contact details for your local carer centre. That's the minimum, really.
Perfect.
In East Sussex, it's Care for the Carers. And if you just Google that, that's the best way to find us. But equally, we've got a range of other referral ways to refer that are in place. And yeah, we'll do that in as straightforward a way as we can. I think the key thing would be asking the person if they have a carer's card, actually, would be really important, because that a lot of those people will have that backup care plan. So by making that phone call, it can release a service which is essentially from East Sussex County Council that could, you know, ideally, there are usually three people who are identified. So it could be kind of next door neighbour, relative that lives half an hour away, or regular, you know, home care provider. And then ultimately, the sort of emergency service through East Sussex that would be able to step in that scenario. So our own services, I'm just thinking, if you've got paramedics there needing to leave one, yeah, our office wouldn't be open at that time. No. That backup plan would be able to kick into place.
That's brilliant. So useful to know, because no idea, and we should definitely know about that. It's really useful. In the episode, we also spoke to Greg Brown, franchise owner of Home Instead Reigate, a care agency based in Reigate, Surrey. We chatted about the challenges of providing domiciliary care, especially if care calls are shorter, the importance of getting to know your clients, and common misconceptions about community care services.
I'm Greg Brown. I own the Reigate and Tandridge Home Instead franchise, which started in 2014. After doing some part-time work with people living with dementia, and understood that, in my view, the only way that support should be given to those people living with dementia is continuity of care, so not lots of different people all the time. The reason I went with Home Instead is because there's a policy of matching people, the same person, a longer visit, and it's an excellent model that works very well. Home Instead is a worldwide organisation started about 30 years ago by a couple looking for something other than just practical help. They wanted somebody to sit with their grandma and do a jigsaw puzzle and look at old photos and take them out and stuff like that. So that wasn't available. And it wasn't available over here until about 20 years ago, when a guy called Trevor Brocklebank bought it into this, and his wife, of course, bought it into this country, because they were looking for the same thing that didn't exist. So there's lots of different perceptions of what a carer is. It can either be a person living with somebody living with dementia, and that person is looking after them most of the time, and they are their primary carer. You've then got the companies that are purely task and time based, which are the ones that do the short visits. So they're sort of 15 minutes, half an hour, those ones will sort of pop in, make sure one's taking their medication and pop and leave again, sort of having ticked off their list. Then you've got us, and we call our care team care professionals, because we're trying to differentiate from those other things to make it a little more clear. So there are people who visit for, in our case, visit for a minimum of 2 hours. I only did that because I worked for Epsom Home Instead. They had a 2 hour minimum visit and it worked really, really well. And so when I started my franchise, I adopted that. But the minimum for Home Instead across the world is an hour. It means that, and I'm not going to, you know, do a sales pitch on the whole thing, but the difference is you can not only get the tasks done, but you've got time to give that other human being the time of the day and a cup of tea, or take them out or whatever. So, yeah, those are the different sorts.
I can imagine that your staff really know their clients really well, because they spend that, if you're spending 2 hours with someone however frequently in a day or a week, that's, you really get to know that person in depth and their home and what their environment's like, which is just so much better.
It's, you know, the care professional thing is about being professional about it. If you say you're going to be there at 10 till 12, you're there 10 o'clock, ringing on the doorbell and leave at 12 o'clock, as opposed to the standard model. And I've got to just, you know, it's broken in this country, the whole bidding for block contracts. It just deteriorates the quality of the care that can be provided, because they've got to make a profit at a minimum margins and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's a more respectful and dignified way of doing it, and the way I'd like it. But moreover, it's a better way of looking after that person, because, given an example where somebody is living with dementia, and you know that person, and you've been with them for a year, and you know all the little nuances, and you know how they behave. If you go in one day and that person has a urinary tract infection, you're going to know, because they're going to be different than usual. Obviously, if you've got lots of different people going and that person hasn't seen that person before, they're just going to assume it's part of the dementia. So it just works better in every respect.
Absolutely. So what do carers, what do your staff tend to do day to day for people? What are the sort of normal things they do?
When we go out to see somebody, we will find out about the practical help that they need. That might be the high dusting, the vacuuming, as we had a 97-year-old lady rang us up recently and said, I'm having trouble with the high dusting and the vacuuming. It's a bit tiring now. So you can help with those practical things. So it falls into three main categories, really. One is personal care. So that is somebody who's, you know, again, it tends to be people living with dementia or another debilitating condition, which means that they either struggle physically to give themselves adequate personal care, or they just don't remember, or they think that they've done it and they haven't. So that's essential. Personal care also falls into medication support, anything that's within your personal space. Then there's home help, which could be the high dusting and the vacuuming, or, you know, just keeping an already house clean. And then there's, importantly, the companionship side of thing, which is everything that we do is revolved around relationship at the heart of it. So to the degree that our you know, remit is our purpose is to contribute to the well-being of the person that we're looking after. If we go in the door and the first thing on that, well, the first thing on the caregivers, care professionals, this will be wash your hands, then it'll be, okay, you know, get the laundry done. If that person says, no, leave the laundry, come and sit down and have a cup of tea with me, I've got something I want to talk to you about. You know, ultimately, if that's what that person wants at that time, you know, bearing in mind they still have to do the laundry, it's that extra time that means you can go down and you can sit there and talk to that person and say, right, okay, made the cup of tea, I've got to go and put the laundry on now.
Well, you've got that time to make that cup of tea, and while the laundry's washing, yeah, you can chat to them, where other services, yeah, they might leave in between and come back.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, exactly how other services work, but what I do know is when I've employed people who've worked in the what we nickname the run-in run-outs, mm-hmm, yeah, when they've worked for one of those and they tell me tales of, you know, doing their teeth while they're sitting on the toilet trying to get them dressed because they're late for their 15th call of the morning when they never had time to do all 15 anyway, you know, it avoids that whole thing. And if you go into, as I have been when I was providing, you know, one-to-one support, I went in and my client, who was usually up, wasn't up, he was in bed, and I went upstairs and I said, are you okay? And he said, no, I'm fed up, or words to that effect. I don't want to be here anymore. And rather than having to say to him, really sorry, I've only got 15 or 20 minutes, you know, I've got to dress you and everything else, I was able to say, okay, you stay there, I'll put the kettle on. So went downstairs, made a cup of tea, made him some toast and marmalade, because I knew he liked toast and marmalade, because I looked after him, got him a daffodil out of the garden, went upstairs, you know, and gave him the time to talk about how he was feeling. So, I mean, in my book, that's what a carer, in inverted commas, you know, if you are caring for somebody, you've got to treat them like a human being.
Yeah.
And not just a number on your list.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
So typical, was that the typical things?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you've covered it. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that humanising care, isn't it? And yes. I mean, that's something we've talked about in previous episodes as well, talking about how sometimes when you're a clinician, especially for the nursing staff, because they're probably our most hands-on within the hospital, they've like, your jobs list is the length of your arm and just getting longer, but actually the person just wants a chat, and that makes the world a difference to you and to the patient. And I think it's easily underestimated.
I didn't mention that we, you know, another thing that older people particularly enjoy, particularly if they're not driving anymore for whatever reason, is getting out of the house. Yeah. Those four walls, you know, can get a little bit boring. And as much as there's lots of stuff on the TV, you know, getting out on a beautiful day and going and sitting at a National Trust property and having a green tea, life is suddenly good again. Mm. you know, just experiencing, interacting with other people, older people, when you take them out, you know, and there's children running around, you know, they love that, a lot of them. So, you know, it's making them feel part of society still and not just locked away in a little room somewhere.
So I wanted to know, are there any misconceptions about things that care professionals can, can't do, things that people maybe expect them to do and they can't or don't have the knowledge or the skills?
I think it depends on your registration with the regulator, the Care Quality Commission. Mm-hmm. You know, we're regulated for personal care. We're not registered currently for medical care. So a misconception would be one of the most common ones. If a client says to their care professional, can you help me cut my fingernails? The answer is no, because it's classed as a medical procedure if you do it with clippers or scissors. Primarily because, you know, somebody with diabetes, something like that, or another condition like that, you know, you can cause some real damage if you do it wrongly. So, yeah, clients think that we can do that, but we can't. I mean, obviously, we'll try and find a way around it and use a nail file. That's allowed, bizarrely. The thing that a lot of people that we end up taking on board are the ones that don't think a care company can take you out, because most don't. So that's a real joy to a lot of people. They just, you know, oh, do you think you can take me shopping? Yes, we can. Can you really? You know, yes, we can.
And I think it's like take you shopping, not just do your shopping.
Oh,
as well.
Totally.
That's
two
different services. Now you've completely said it, and I completely didn't think of that before.
Yeah, no, you get the one and they can choose the cut of meat that they like, or the cheese that they can't remember the name of, or whatever it is, you know. And again, it's about being occupied. It's one of the core psychological needs, isn't it? Yeah.
Although I can imagine it's hard for your staff. If you create that relationship with someone, it must be really hard when things change, or that person's really ill, or that person stops receiving care from your company.
It is. Like, I think one of the hardest things is when they die.
Yeah.
You know, because you have, and I've been there, and I worked as a care professional for about a year and a half before setting up my own. And I got very close to my clients and my clients' family. In fact, I'm still in touch with my clients' families from 2012, one of them. But I was a pallbearer at his funeral at the request of the family, because we had such a close relationship. And you do, it hurts. I had somebody in tears in the office beginning of this week who was, you know, her client has died. And she said, I didn't realise that I'd take it this hard. But you do, because, you know, but if they didn't, then they wouldn't be the right people for the job, because they wouldn't have the compassion and empathy and everything else.
So my last sort of question was sort of about assessments, and when you're getting a new client, how do you assess their needs for care, and what information do you want from hospitals, health teams, or families, like, to help you build that picture of the person?
Okay, so this has got room for improvement. Everything is about room for, you know, we're always trying to improve what we do. And there's a wider conversation at the moment about the domiciliary care sector, particularly being more involved with the NHS, and, you know, those lines of communication being opened up so we can all work together for the best outcomes for that person. The way we currently do it is we have a head of client care who will go out, meet the client, any members of their family that they'd like, and fundamentally ask them what they want, you know. And that, again, falls into the practical side of things. And then the, you know, the sort of social side of things. We will do a risk assessment on the house. We'll do a risk assessment on the person, if there's mobility issues, if there's anything like that. Find out all about the medication. And then we get a snapshot, really, of what that person's needs are. And, you know, we go away and match them with somebody who we think is going to, who they're going to get along with. And we think, you know, ideally, if it's somebody who's got a common denominator. I mean, when I went to Epsom Home Instead, they asked me what I did outside of work. And I said, I play chess, I play golf, and I take my sons fishing when I can. And they matched me, and this is as good as it gets, with a chess player, a golfer, and a fisherman. You know, what more can you ask? So, I remember sitting there thinking, you know, it might not be a huge amount I'm getting paid, but I'm actually getting paid to sit here and play chess, which is great. So there's an initial assessment. You put together the care plan with all the medication and everything else that, you know, that person needs. And then after the first 2 weeks, we have a first service review. So that is, did what we think it's going to look like, is that actually what it looks like? Or is there more that we are being asked to do, or is some of the stuff we identify we're not being asked to do? So that's the 2 week service review. And then every 6 months, there's a service review. But every 3 months, as an absolute minimum, there's a touch point. So it might be a quality assurance visit, a spot check, or a support visit for the caregiver. So we're always impressing upon our care professionals that they are the eyes and ears. You know, we have the three R's: recognize, report, record. So, you know, you've got to be vigilant, notice if there's a change in anything. If there is, tell someone and write it down. So that we can evolve. The care plan is, it doesn't just stand still, it evolves over time. So, yeah, it's a conversation, really, that the important thing is to put that client at the centre of their care planning so that they feel in control. They still have the yellow hat. You know, they're the boss. They just tell us what to do. And that they feel valued and have their dignity. It's, you know, I think people are so worried about care. I mean, we have a huge amount of resistance always, you know, not always. A vast percentage of people are reluctant to have support at home because it's an admission that they can't do it any, you know, can't look after themselves as well as they used to, which absolutely fits with the way your subconscious works, because it knows that you've done that for the whole of your life. And no, that isn't normal. So it doesn't like it. So it feels uncomfortable. So keeping that person at the center of their own support is absolutely key, and not taking over. You know, as you say, it's not about doing the shopping for them. It's about taking the shopping.
We hope you got as much as we did from these interviews and would love to hear your feedback. You can contact us via our website at www.mdtpodcast.co.uk, Twitter at @MDT_podcast, via Facebook, where we are facebook.com/MDTpodcast, and Instagram at @MDTpodcast. We'll be back with the main episode in June's Journey next week.
The MDT Podcast.